mistakes that people make.
Well, hello there. How is it going? This is Sarah Mangle talking to you through the radio. Good morning. This is These Things That People Make, and it's a show about things people make that are not considered fine art and the politics involved in making them. And partially I do this show about things that aren't considered fine art because I went to art school, and at art school I learned about sort of the elitism of visual art, and wasn't that into it. I mean, I was into art school because you get to do lots of creative projects and meet lots of neat people and hear a lot of history that's quite interesting, and I in particular enjoyed art theory. But also, people were making really interesting crafts in my classes, and the teachers were really not into it because they were like, well, I mean, for example, we had somebody who made a quilt in my print and dye class, and my teacher said, well, that looks like something you could put on your bed. And it just sort of surfaced this thing where we have people all around us making really awesome projects, and they're just not considered as high art or as intelligent or as valuable as fine art. And also there's, you know, there's some gender things, there's some race things going on there, there's some ability things where we have folk art or outsider art made by people who are diagnosed as disabled in various ways, that their work is not considered real work. There's a lot of condescension within the realm of discussing outsider art. So there's a lot of things going on, and I was like, the things my friends and their friends and strangers that I haven't met yet are making are really cool and relate to our everyday lives in a more real way, and that's more interesting to me. So that's why my show is the way it is, and the reason why I'm telling you more information about that, friends, today, this morning, is because it does fit in with what we're talking about today. I am playing the second part of an interview that I did with Jesse and Charlie Huskin, who are the owner and junior partner of This Ain't the Rosedale Library, which was a bookstore that had three locations in Toronto, small independent bookstore, and its last location was 86 Nassau Street in Kensington Market, and they recently had to close their doors. And because the climate for bookstores right now, independent bookstores in Toronto, it's very difficult to stay alive, and gentrification makes rent very impossible to pay, and gentrification makes life very expensive for people, so it's harder for them to support their local bookstores. So this is the second part of that interview. I met both of them about a week and a half ago at Sonic Cafe on Cecil Street in Toronto, and we, in the first part of the interview, talked about the history of the bookstore. It started in 1979 by Charlie Huskin. He was a bookseller for another small bookstore, and he decided to go out on his own and really bring interesting books that he didn't think were being distributed in Toronto to Toronto, and also booking a lot of authors to speak in a lot of events. And the store's been going ever since. It was at Church and Wellesley for a long, long time, and then moved to Kensington Market. And so in this next, the next part of the interview that I'm going to read, not read, what am I even talking about? I'm thinking about reading. The next part of the interview that I play will be Jesse talking about what he thinks needs to happen for there to be a climate to support independent bookstores in Toronto. And I guess this other piece that I want to bring back from last week's part of the interview is just this part about readers and wanting to offer a wide variety of really interesting literature to readers in Toronto, and sort of grieving the fact that it's very hard to do that right now in the current climate. I also want to say that, like, we're having this conversation within the context of Pages Bookstore recently closing in Toronto, Glad Day Books, one of Canada's oldest gay and lesbian bookstore, is struggling to stay alive, and the Toronto Women's Bookstore just almost closed. So there's many bookstores that have been surviving for a long, long time that are now really facing a lot of challenges. So think about all of that stuff within that context and listen to the next part of the interview.
A little bit about independent wealthy people helping out small stores. What else do you think needs to happen for small bookstores to be able to bring interesting distribution to Toronto specifically?
Well, the one that leaps to mind is distribution, as I was saying before. It's absurd that, you know, a press like New Directions, you know, stores in Toronto will pick whatever has become famous of the moment. You know, we're talking about the one of the only small presses in the U.S. that functions, as a solvent company. They're not publicly owned or funded by any foundations, and even that, you know, base level of culture just barely trickles into the country. Even though they're distributed by a giant, you know, they're distributed by Penguin Books, which is like one of the largest, you know, distributors and companies in North America. So distribution, and then the other obvious thing is in terms of bringing in authors. The circulation. I mean, obviously there's the Toronto International Festival of Authors, which is, you know, which is giant, and there's nothing in between. So the chances of you know a North American or a European author of them popularizing their writing here at all are minuscule. I would urge people to you know start reading literary blogs and writing on the internet before, you know, before assuming that they're educated about what's available and what's interesting. The other thing is the way people treat cities now is has become kind of a product of the city's worst problems. That the people, even in a city as accessible and, you know, as Toronto, where there's, you know, fantastic transportation and it's easy to get around, people don't bother to explore it. They very seldom venture out of their sort of myth of what the city is. And even as the city changes incredibly rapidly, people aren't catching up with it. They're content to stay at home and go to their usual spots and then come back home and complain that, you know, it's not like it used to be, and Queen Street isn't what it was, and Church Street isn't what it was, and, you know, sorry, Charlie, but instead, they have to be adventurers, you know, within their own city and actually find these places, and you don't have to support them in some sort of earnest political way. It's more that you'll be rewarded if you actually find, you know, our store. It took so long for people to find our store. And in a way, we weren't expecting that. We thought it would be the other way around, that, you know, when the store opened, there would be more interest, and then it would be our task to keep it, right? Which is the way it actually usually works. But in Toronto, it's, you know, they're in that neighborhood, that dirty neighborhood, you know, Kensington Market, where, you know, I have to go out of my way now to get there. And, you know, how difficult was it to get to Church Street? This is more central. And so all this kind of, like, stubbornness about the geography of the city has to change in any North American city, you know, now at this point. So it's changing rapidly. And it does in some places, like a more dynamic city like New York. It's changed massively. The neighborhoods that people go to shop for books and, you know, vintage clothing are totally different from what they were 5 years ago. But you don't, you see a lot of stores that are very similar to our store thriving in New York. Maybe I shouldn't say that since I don't, you know the, you know, what situation some of those owners are in, but they're certainly still around. So that's kind of, it's difficult for my dad and I to look at those stores and then think about Toronto and not feel a little bit of jealousy or maybe disappointment in our city that we were offering, you know, a very similar selection, if not better. And people didn't respond to it in the same way. The people who did were, you know, almost shocked that we were there. You know, I can't believe I haven't found this store, you know. I can't believe I'd never heard of you guys or hadn't been to this new location. And, you know, people buying little stacks of things. But that's very different than having the kind of constant traffic that you really need for a store to function. So I think that's all that has to happen, is that people have to be more adventurous about their cities and actually have much, much greater expectations for what a city should offer them. People treat Toronto as a sort of like this nice base, you know, to develop their career so they can leave. I know a lot of people who treat it that way, and it's hard to argue against their philosophy. You know, there isn't a lot to entice me to stay here right now. Certainly the trade I work in doesn't present a lot of opportunities now with the stores closing. So I am looking at Toronto in a really broad context. So.
You are listening to These Things That People Make on CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph and on the internet at www.cfru.ca. You can also hear lots of archives of shows from the past 6 weeks if you go to that website. And I'm airing an interview with owner and junior partner of This Ain't the Rosedale Library, which is a bookstore in Toronto that recently closed its doors. And I'm just going to read you their post from their website. We are sincerely touched by the outpouring of sympathy and understanding that so many people have shown us over the last few days. It is overwhelming that such a diverse group of people all feel strongly about the books that we stock, the place that we create for them, and the way that we champion them. We offer our thanks to each one of you and have trouble finding the words to repay this kindness. We are, however, in the disappointing position of having had our formal proposal to the landlord rejected. Our proposal to work for her to liquidate our stock was dismissed with the argument that the cost of repaying security or a bailiff observe the process would outweigh the gain. Our proposal did not include security or a bailiff's presence during the process. Clearly, we are not trusted. With no negotiation of our terms of payment available to us, we have to accept that the store has no future at this location. This might seem anticlimactic, and some of our supporters may feel that there must be something else we can do. We ask for your trust that we have, for some time now, considered all the options, and we have the support of a lawyer in formalizing them. Our only hope is to imagine that the store may reemerge in the long term. At this point, a fundraiser could only be a Pyrrhic victory. We encourage all those who have shown such enthusiasm for our store to consider helping us and stores of our kind in the future. While we are open to suggestions, we are hoping that our own unfortunate case might offer others opportunity to seriously consider factors which contribute to making and creating and running a bookstore such a challenge in North America. Predatory pricing of Amazon, inflated rents in urban centers, remaindering of excessive print runs demanded by big box stores and corporate publishing have had a devastating effect on smaller entrepreneurs. We are still of the feeling that without big changes, and the best and most satisfying way to support indies is to explore the stores in your city, browse their selection, trust your own curiosity, and buy gift certificates if nothing suits you. We cannot help but feel guilty for disappointing everyone who has demonstrated their hope that we might resolve our difficulties in the store in the short term. We invite anybody who might feel that we have breached their trust in this respect to contact us at info@thesaint.ca. And that comes from thesaintblog.wordpress.com. I'm going to go back to the interview now.
Our risk-taking can only be matched by the general populations.
Yeah.
You know, because it's not rewarding in a bourgeois city to be a pioneer. It just doesn't work that way. And, you know, Jess thinks I'm being a little nostalgic about 1979 and Queen Street East, but there was a time when there was that equal kind of partnership between an adventurous clientele and an adventurous bookstore. And Pages on Queen West found that same kind of partnership. And the mentoring was in all directions and from all directions, so that I would occasionally be wised up to what was going on by teenage clientele, as well as, you know, continuing to hang out with, say, Tom Hodgson, who was born in, I think, sometime during the 1920s. So we had the full range of, you know, where information and tips about, you know, what was new or in some cases old and would be good to think of reviving. And you can find that a little bit in this city now and in the GTA. You know, you're coming from Guelph, you know, people in Toronto should never look down their noses at anything that's going on in St. Catharines or Hamilton or Peterborough or Guelph, because, you know, there are all kinds of little interesting pods of activities going on, and within our own city as well, you know, like maybe Queen Street isn't what it used to be, well, who cares, let's go to the Junction, or let's go to Danforth. You know, let's check things out and see what we can do, you know? But it's so hard when we started the store in 79 and the minimum wage was $4 and we were paying $400 a month rent. So, you know, rule of thumb there, $4 to 400. That's 100 times, you know, for a month's rent. Well, now the landlady is asking $3,600 for the space we vacated, and minimum wage is what?
$10.50.
Yeah, so that's 360 times the minimum wage.
And well, minimum wage isn't even a living wage for people at this point either. So in fact, you know, what you have to offer people is more than that in terms of their benefits and all of that.
And that's part of the problem too that Jesse pointed out, that maybe people aren't exploring their own city the way they could and should. But if you're working two jobs just to make ends meet, how can you explore? It's hard, you know? And one thing about the 70s is when I was, you know, spending far too much time at Grossman's across the street, we had that kind of time, and there was always somebody around, if it wasn't us, ourselves, to buy us the next round, you know? And it's just a lot tougher now, and expectations are different as well. You know, I mean, look at a place that's a hotbed in terms of, you know, Toronto Life's view of what's going on in the city, Ossington. Well, it's a hard slog for Tim Hanna to keep Frantic City, a very interesting secondhand bookstore, going. Because, you know, the trust fund kids who come down there with their, you know, their gold cards and their Amex cards, they really don't care about what he has to offer. If they do, it's really, again, the exception that proves the rule. It's tough. It's really tough.
Would you guys ever consider buying a space?
With what?
Yeah.
We would love to buy a space. If you're offering, I have something like $500 that I could put as a down payment.
Yeah, me too. I could give you $500.
Well, this is the other issue is that, I mean, one thing that kind of lessens some of the sting of our argument is that there are, you know, some bookstores in Toronto which, you know, seem to be doing quite well and do focus on the literary and the art. And they're, you know, it's hard for us to say why that is and explain it, but there's certainly, you can say, a lot of barriers to entry in this business. And that's how, when a business is doing really well commercially in a kind of a neighborhood where they can sell books to fairly well-off people, the kind of selection they have is really governed by the sort of appeal as gifts and ostentatious, conspicuous consumption, you know. I'm going to start to sound like Veblen.
Well, it's not the same as building a readership or building your library or building a relationship with authors.
That's right. When your customers are poor, they have to be, you know, absolutely addicted or fanatical about what you're selling them. And the books aren't bought, you know, as gifts. They're bought as you know, things to be indulged in and read. And so the kind of these stores thrive, you know, and there aren't actually that many of them in Toronto, but what they offer is just so extraordinarily different from what a literary bookstore is supposed to offer. You know, I have to say all this without mentioning any names, but there just isn't a kind of resource the way there used to be for readers in the city. It's quite bleak, and I can understand why people, you know, kind of give up on you know, literature.
You are listening to These Things That People Make on CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. And we're talking about bookstores, independent bookstores, bringing interesting things, more in-depth literature to our cities. Personally, I'm going to turn this music down a little bit because it's a little too hyper. Personally, I feel like, I think the role of literature in people's lives varies a great deal, but for me, I think in particular the role of the novel and the novel that's based sort of like in history in some way teaches me a lot about the communities that came before me, the work people did before me, the organizing people did before me, the ideas people had, the dialogue, blah blah blah. What happens if we can't find those books? What happens if people are doing really interesting things and we can't read about them because we can't find them? And what does it say about our cities and our communities and our provincial and federal government that they don't value literature enough to support the distribution of books or to consider literature to be important, to be learning about different things. These are all things I'm thinking about as I'm listening to this interview. I'm going to play the last part of it now. I would like to say that in the next part of the interview, I talk about the Bookshelf as being the only independent bookstore in Guelph. I do know that there are some others, specifically I'm thinking about Macondo. So when I'm talking about bookstores in this part of the interview, I meant bookstores that sell new books.
I live in Guelph. The one bookstore that we have that is like a small bookstore is the Bookshelf. The Bookshelf does very well, is very interested in small publishers, but at the same time, based on the community we're in, has to provide a broad base of things. So often they will order books in for me. But in terms of offering readers something interesting as they walk in the door, happens, I think, less than they would probably like to.
Yeah. Yeah, when I visited Guelph, I used to shop at that store, and it was great. But as it becomes more and more difficult, you know, even stores that seem a little offbeat and more interesting, their mandate is that, you know, if a book doesn't sell, you know, 10 copies a year, they can't afford the shelf space. Even though, you know, a lot of the more interesting things that started to really pick up for us were things that it took us, you know, 2 years to begin to interest people in because there was no context for it. And, you know, I find it ironic that, you know, days after our store was closed, a book that I had been, you know, trying to sell people for whatever, I suppose it would be a year and a half, you know, I got 2 emails, people in Montreal special ordering it. You know, this was a book by Aaron Kunin, who's an American, you know, poet and just wrote a novel. It takes a long time to introduce things to an audience, you know. But if it can reach Montreal, then obviously there's, you know, some interest in it.
So what are your future hopes for the Saint a unique series in the Saint the Rosedale Library? What are you thinking about now?
Long pause.
We would love to, you know, do it all again with more security. And that takes a lot of time to negotiate. And I think people have to realize that this was, you know, never done with any savings or resources. All the money went right back into the store. And, you know, a lot of retail functions that way of any kind. So there's all these, you know, as I was saying, barriers. And we have to look at all of the options, you know, including public ones. Publishing is incredibly supported by the public sector. But there's no place to meet and browse books, and there's no place to champion books or to, you know, focus on their reception in their festivals, but there's no place. You know, you need a place for things. Otherwise, you don't have any kind of public forum on them. It's all moved to the internet in that respect, and that creates a kind of a placeless. You know, there's no, you know, there are no neighborhoods developing in Toronto that are, you know,